continuing on the topic of the role of Rov and how we say Ein Holchim Lamon Achar HaRov, when we say that, if we say that, and how we saw some of the apparently conflicting and contradictory attitudes that appear throughout Shas as far as this is concerned. So yesterday we focused specifically on the idea that we have a statement of Shmuel that Ein Holchin B'Mamon Achar HaRov, and yet we do find many times in the Torah where we follow Rov even for issues of executing people, which would seem to be much more chamer than monetary issues. And at the same time, we have this attitude of Ein Holchin B'Mamon Achar HaRov. What exactly is going on? So we focused on two approaches that you find in Tosfosin, two different Tosfosin. One approach, which was that the roles just come out differently, that when you're dealing with a monetary dispute between two people and one of them is a muchzak, and the other one has a rove, so the muchzak, first of all, is a muchzak, and the fact that there's a miyut, that there's a minority, that reflects his position, so that means his position is viable. So he can combine his miyut with his robe, with his muchzak rather, his muchzak and his miyut, M&M, and that allows him to win. While in the case of the miyut and a bezdin, this is all from Tosfos and Bava Kamma, in the miyut and a bezdin, they have a three-panel bezdin, so the one outvoted position essentially is negated, doesn't exist anymore, and therefore the bezdin flips completely to the majority position. So there isn't any status left to the minority. That was Tosfos' Bava Kamma. And we aligned that Tosfos with basically saying that what it seems to mean is that Rov cannot effectively act against the Chazaka. And when it comes to a Chazaka, so you have the principle of Ein Hamotzi Mechavero Olav Haraya. Somebody's going to act against the Mozak. He needs proof. And the Rov does not rise to that level. Rove is essentially not absolute proof. The other guy has a miyut, that means his possibility is viable, so how could you say Rove is an absolute proof? It's simply not a raya, and therefore probably adding other things to the Rove, like Cheskas HaGuf and the like, is probably not going to help. While Tosfos and Sanhedrin took a different approach, Tosfos and Sanhedrin said, really, we do follow Rove, but the Rove where the Gemara says, Ein Holchim Amar Achar Rove, that was simply not a good enough Rove. But a rove that was really strong enough, that would be motzi min hamochzak. So in that case, it's not really that rove fundamentally can't be motzi mamon. It's just that the rove that we talk about when we say such things is not powerful enough. But if you have a strong rove, if you add on some points, then theoretically it could work. Okay, so with that, so just to add a few more points. One point is, we're setting up those two toasters in, as saying fundamentally different things, like we just said, but you could still say it's all really all one continuum, that essentially it's all about just how strong is your rove, that rove could theoretically be a raya if it's so powerful, if it's so absolute, you know, so unquestioned, it could rise to the level of a raya, while a rove that's the more typical kind of rove that you see simply doesn't have the juice, doesn't have the power to rise to that level, but it's theoretically possible. So as much as we're holding these two toasts enough as being fundamentally opposed to each other, still it is possible to kind of plot them along a continuum and say that it's also a question of how much is the role actually convincing. That in order to be Motsumama, we need a convincing proof. And your average rove doesn't cut it, but a rove that really rises to that level would theoretically cut it, and maybe we could come up with a situation where it does. So it's interesting to note, for example, the Sefer Hafla, the Sefer Sefes Tzubis, so he suggests that the cases that we seem to find contradictions, sometimes we do follow a rove, sometimes we don't follow a rove. So you might say, let's say, if it's all going to be about monetary cases, so what about, let's say, a pigeon aben? A pigeon aben, we make the father pay the kohen for the pigeon aben, but theoretically, if the child turns out not to be a viable child, the child then turns out not to be other than a treifa, or if the child is actually not the child of his father, as we discussed yesterday, could also be. So he's not really obligated in pidgin abet. So we're relying on rov to be motzi mamon from the father in that case. So the hafla suggests a general principle that really we do follow rov. So certainly if there's any area of life where a certain status is being determined, and that will have implications for many areas, including mamonos, so we'll follow the rov throughout. And the only time we say ain't hope of mamon after a rov, that is when you have a case where there aren't going to be any other implications other than this monetary clash with a muhzak. And in that case, okay, so then we won't be mostly mamon based on this. But if elsewhere halacha, we're establishing that this is true, like we're establishing that this baby is the son of the father, so then for the monetary purposes also, we follow it through and we don't bifurcate and we don't say that this same fact will acknowledge it for the purposes of other areas of halacha, but we won't acknowledge it for the purposes of being motzi mamon. It's also interesting that there is a whole discussion that we had that the Kintrus HaSfeikis, Kintrus HaSfeikis is the brother of the Ksos HaChoshen. He's also the author of the Sefer Truma Sakri. So the Kintrus HaSfeikis asks, how could you say that we don't use rov to take away from a muhzak? We don't use rov in monetary issues to take away from somebody who's holding on to the money, but we do use it for nefashos. And nefashos, the person is also a muhzak. He's a muhzak in his life. Right? So how can we use rov in order to take away from the mosa? So many acharonim discuss this question. You could maybe argue whether you think it's a good question or not. But perhaps where it seems to reflect in a little bit the mechanics of what's going on here, that when we say ein motzi mamon, we say ein hocham mamon achar rov, that we can't use a rov to take money away from the mosa. The kind of situations that we're normally talking about is that we mean that we're trying to figure out what is the truth of this case. So the fact that he's a muhzak on the money, that indicates to us some credibility to his position, that he's the actual owner. So the rov is not enough to fight that off. But when you're dealing with sentencing someone to death, so the cheskas chayim that he has, the fact that he's already alive and you're trying to take the life away from the muhzak, that fact says nothing about the truth of the case. If this person did something that he's chayiv misa for, so the fact that he's currently alive tells us nothing about whether he's guilty or not. So the question, whether or not you think it's a good question, but it kind of highlights the difference in terms of the mechanism. That when we're dealing with these monetary cases and we say, ein holtim olam afa harov, so it could be that really what we mean is that the cheskas mamon shows us something about the strength of disposition. And rov is not strong enough to overcome that. While the question about the nefashos, that's not what's going on. It's irrelevant to figuring out the truth of the case. It's just that we need to use this psak to remove his life from him. But that's completely sidebar to the question of what are the actual facts and elements of this case itself.
Also, when we see the rove by somebody's life, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about the rove of the dynamic, right?
Right. Well, so not exclusively so, though. I mean, that's one of the cases where it comes up.
Because by the way, it's not, because then, you know, the answer is kind of like from yesterday, is that it's really one decision as opposed to a factual basis, 70% yes, 30% disagree. It's really one decision.
Right, but that's only one of the cases where it comes up. The Gemara Sanhedrin uses in that context. We do use it in other contexts also, like you mentioned, for example, yesterday, that a person could be chayav misa for hitting his father, even though the fact that the father is the father is only ascertained through rov. We don't really know the father is actually the father, except we work off the premise that most fathers are the husbands of the mothers. So if that's true, so you say there also we have a rov. You could similarly argue that that rov is irrelevant to figuring out whether or not he actually committed the crime. It's important for the background of the situation. But we're kind of taking it as a given that he actually is the father, and that's not what's being argued in court,
right?
That he's not the father. The court is trying to figure out, did he hit him or not?
Mm-hmm.
So the rove, there's no rove that's playing a role in determining that, as a, and there's no chazaka that's opposing it.
And if the case was that, and the question is whether he is his father or not, then that would be a different story.
Right. Well, whether it's his father or not, maybe that would be a different story.
Right.
We mentioned yesterday that the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that there's a Kal v'chomer from Dinei Nefashos to Dinei Mamonos. But according to what we just said, there shouldn't be no Kal v'chomer because the chazaka is different in each case by Dinei Mamonos.
Right. So well, either way, that Gemara is a steer to other dinim. So we have to sharpen it a little bit. And we have to say that on the one hand, we have Shmuel's position in other Gemaras that when you're dealing with taking money away from Muxa, we don't follow a rove. And when the Gemara in Sanhedrin says the Kal v'chomer is talking about in terms of this issue of counting up dayanim, that we'll rely on the majority of dayanim for monetary things, and Kal v'chomer for nefashos rather, and Kal v'chomer for monetary things. So the bottom line is the Gemara is talking about something else, but we still have to figure out why what they're talking about is different than what other Gemaras are talking about. So that's a part of the issue. It's also interesting just to throw in one or two more points. That there are Rishonim who suggest, the Tosfos in the first parak, that we will be motzi mamlin min hamuchzak based on a state seker. Right? That if I have two sekers in my favor, in my case against you, so I can be motzi mamlin for you. So some of the Achronim say, well, why is that true? Right? That what's the power of a state seker? So some Achronim say like this, and some Rishonim say like this part of the equation, that Seik Sveika means that normally if I have a Safek, it's basically 50-50. I don't know what the truth is. You go either way. But if I have two Sveikas together, mathematically, so it's 75-25. So now I have a rove. I have a 75% odds in my favor. So if that's the way we understand it, so it translates to a rove, so how could you be Motzi Mamlin with that? You don't be Motzi Mamlin with a rove. So that's how some Achronim ask. So others explain that you could say it differently. You could say that, no, rove in general is just a way of tilting your default, saying, I don't know who's right here, so majority is on his side, so we'll go with him. But it's not really a definitive statement. But Sveika, you could say, actually is a definitive statement. You could say that a suffix is something which makes you wonder if it's true. Something is true until you have a suffix that calls it into question. And then when you have a Sveika, we're saying that that suffix itself is a suffix. It's not enough of a suffix to unseat things, because even within that suffix is a possibility the original premise is still true. So therefore, it basically undermines the suffix. That a sveika means a safek that is itself in suffix. So therefore we don't have a question now, so we're left with our original premise that this is true. So therefore that should be enough to be motzi min hamuchzak. Which is also an interesting position to take. Just mention, I think, two more points. One, as we've mentioned not as many times this year, one of my often quoted Mechaber of Nassim Gishtetner, his Sefer Nassim Kirio from Sechas Bav Metzia. So he has a few other suggestions as to why it is that we follow Rove in all these other areas of life and not to be Mosim and Amosa. So he suggests, basically frames the question as follows. First of all, the Gemara does say elsewhere that Ruba v'chazaka, Ruba Adif, but in general, if you have a clash between a rove and a chazaka, rove is generally stronger than a chazaka. So why is it that the cheskes mamon wins out over rove? Right, apparently, all the other kinds of chazaka is rove wins, but there's one specific type of chazaka, the cheskes mamon, the person is currently holding on to the money, that makes him win against a rove. So what's magic about that one type of chazaka as opposed to all the other kinds of chazakas? A cheskes marakama, for example. Like, let's say you knew that somebody owned this item, let's say somebody owned the land beforehand. Right? Like, if, for example, the Gemara of Baba Basra talk about
we have somebody who's living on land right now, and he claims he bought it. And the person who owned the land last year says, no, you didn't buy it, you're stealing my land. So that person is called the Marakama, the original owner. So he has the chazaka that we know that he once upon a time owned it. But that's not as strong of a chazaka. A rov could work against him. It's only the chezkas mamam when somebody is holding on to the money right now, that is this kind of magic chazaka that defeats a rov. So why is that true? Why is this chazaka stronger than all other chazaka? So one possibility, suggests, is that this is the only chazaka that is visible, that we can look at it and we can see it, and that it's referencing something that's going on right now. Every other chazaka is either abstract or conceptual or debatable or talking about something that was in the past. And this is the one chazaka that reflects what is right now, and that you can look at it, you can see this person is holding this item, and that's true right now. That gives it a more, you might call it epistemic value, gives it more points as far as establishing what's true than any other type of chazaka. So essentially it is still, again, on a scale. It's just that really rov is stronger than chazaka in general. But this kind of chazaka, I guess, extra points for its currency and visibility. Guess what?
That would be true if, for example, we use roves and chazakas to perhaps prove something about the situation. But this chazaka, chazkas mamon, it's not really, theoretically, it's not really proving anything. Because, you know, let's say someone gives money to someone else, they want to take it back, and the guy denies that he gave it to him.
Mm-hmm.
So half the time, half the situations you're going to have someone who has the money and does deserve it, and half the situations you're going to have someone who has the money and doesn't deserve it. So it shouldn't really be an indication as to who is lying and who's not lying.
Well, it's a little bit of a question of your numbers. I mean, what you say is theoretically true, but is it really half the time? That's a part of the issue, that's part of why we have what to talk about in the first place. Right. So to use the secular version of this principle, which is going to itself challenge numbers, right? To say possession is 9/10 of the law. Right? So what does that mean? It's not 100% of the law, but it's not 50% of the law. So what it means is that possession is a pretty strong indicator. But we do acknowledge the fact, as you're saying, that it's possible for somebody to possess something that's not his. Right? It's possible he stole it. It's possible that he borrowed it. And the Gemara does elsewhere make distinctions for items that are likely to be borrowed and be in the hands of somebody other than the owner. Right, so we know that there are cases where possession is not equal to ownership. So therefore it's not 100% of the law. But in so many cases it's indicative of ownership that it carries a lot of weight. And that's essentially what he's saying in this explanation, that really it should be categorized with everything else. It should be just like one other factor, like a cheskas marakama or a cheskas aguf or whatever, one of the chazaka meikar, one of these indicators that something might be true, but it's not 100%. So maybe a rov should really be more powerful. But the answer is that you're right theoretically, but this is actually a very strong chazaka. So whether you call it the secular terminology 9/10 of the law, or whether you use this particular explanation where you're saying the fact that we could look at it right now, the fact that it's talking about a current state rather than a previous state, those are elements that make it stronger, and that's why this is the one chazaka that breaks away from the pack and becomes more powerful than a rove. So on one hand, you could really argue numbers if it was really the case that half the time, like you said, people who possess things don't own it, so then it probably wouldn't have so much power. And that's, again, where you find other Gemaras that say that if that's the reality of the situation, you're dealing with something that people tend to lend out more regularly, and it's very often the case that people possess something that's not actually theirs, then maybe in those cases a cheskes mamon wouldn't be so powerful. But in the average case, the cheskes mamon carries a lot of weight, even though we know there's a chance that it's stolen, a chance that it was borrowed, a chance of something else, but that chance is considered to be a relatively low possibility.
Are we saying that the chazaka is stronger because, in most cases, it's a not abstract way of looking at possession?
Or that it's not abstract in itself, that all other chazakas are often abstract, or either abstract or talking about the past, or in some way weaker. Either they're very conceptual, you know, most people do this, you know, that's kind of abstract, we don't even know how to prove that exactly, you know, or it's whether it's talking about a statistical kind of chazaka, or whether it's talking about a default position. So some of these are a little bit more vague, while here we're talking about something which is observable, which is current. So just those factors make it weighted more than other types of indicators.
I'm thinking in terms of, let's say, money in the bank. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't consider, nobody would be able to look at the money in your bank and say, oh, that section of the money is this person's or that.
I mean, it wouldn't be so observable.
Right.
I mean, it would be observable in other ways, right? Because you could go to the bank and they have records of your having the money. So, you know, whether it means it has to practically translate to everything being in your physical possession in the same way, well, you have to take it that far. But I think his general point is well taken, that this has a status above other chazakas in terms of how it's perceived. Okay. So that's one approach that he has. Another approach that he has is that in general, some of these tools of credibility are only effective in taking things up one notch. And when you need to be motzi min hamuchzak, you need to essentially do two things. You need to first remove the item from the possession of the muchzak, and then assign it to the possession of the claimant. And if you think about this for a second, so let's say Shmuley and Daniel were fighting over something, and Daniel's the muchzak. So for Shmuley to win, two things have to happen. One is we have to remove it from Daniel's possession, so he's no longer the muchzak. And we have to assign it to Shmuley. Now, if we stopped halfway, right, if we removed it from Daniel's possession, so now it's 50-50, so he should have equal standing getting it back. So for Shmuley to win that 50-50 clash, he needs another factor in his favor. So the factor of Rove is only enough to take it one step, is not enough to take it two steps. It's complicated calculus of how these credibilities work, but that's another possibility. A third approach he mentions is that essentially the issue of not being motzi mamon and a motzak with a rove is basically an issue of religious responsibility. That basically we're concerned of the isser of gzeila. That theoretically, yes, if we have to choose, so one, the muchzak has something, and the claimant has a 75% robe that it's his. So, alright, so if we have to choose, so we would choose the claimant, if that was the only thing at stake. But because the muchzak has it right now, to take it away from the muchzak and give it to the claimant, so then there may be an issue of gezel now, because maybe it's not really the person who's claiming it. So because we're choshesh to gezel, so therefore that's what makes us come to a different decision.
Maybe gezel either way.
So not necessarily, because the person who is the muchzak is holding on to it right now. So in order to assign it to the other person, so we have to...
That person who's holding it right now, it's all original.
Right, maybe he did, right, but there's not a continuing act of gezel. You know, that we would be committing, Bezdin would be committing an act of gezel by taking it away from the person who has it right now. That scares us a little bit. We're choshesh to that possibility, and that's why we come to this decision of not being motzi min hamuchzak. Hi.
We usually say hafker Bezdin, hafker.
Correct, so theoretically, if the Bezdin were to make the decision for that reason, then they have the right to decide who owns what, if that's how they're going to operate. But if they're trying to operate based on the localized mitzvahs of the case, you know, theoretically, you could also get into all kinds of questions, all kinds of above mitzvah questions, when you have the different strategies that we alluded to before Yontif, of how we decide conflicts between people. So you do get into questions like that, of what right does the Bezdin have to force people to split the talis or to confiscate property and the like. But in general, if they're not going to overtly employ a tactic like that, so then the question of how do you decide that it goes to one rather than goes and then gets taken away from one to give to another, so that maybe that gives us a concern that Gezel might be involved. Okay, so this is an important understanding because it's relevant to something we mentioned yesterday. Like we said that when it comes to nefashos, so we seem to rely on a rogue as far as executing a person who hits his father and the like, or executing somebody who a majority of the Sanhedrin decides deserves it. But when it comes to other cases, we don't seem to follow the rogue for nefashos. We gave the example of pikuach nefesh. If the Gemara says in Yuma that if somebody is buried under a building and it involves Chil Shabbos to dig him out, so even though there might be a rogue chance that he's dead already and it's not pikuach nefesh, we do it anyway because ain't halachim be pikuach nefesh achar harov. So what does that really mean practically? What it really seems to mean is that we are choshesh to the minority for the purposes of pikuach nefesh. That the mandate of pikuach nefesh is so significant that if there's only a minority chance that it's relevant, we will act on that even for the purposes of even to go against the rogue. But a more common example that we have nowadays is, you know, like we just had Yom Kippur, right? It's a question of fasting in Yom Kippur. So let's say a person is possibly sick. So, you know, if the doctor decides that a person has a 5% chance of dying if he fasts, so we'll tell that person not to fast. Even though we'll say, we've got Rove, it's a 95% chance he won't die. So we'll say, Ein halachim b'pikuach nefesh achar harov. But what do we mean by that? What we mean is that the mandate of pikuach nefesh, the need to protect this person's life, is so strong that even just a 5% chance that that's the situation, we will worry about it. But in the cases of executing someone, or in the cases of, let's say, following the majority of the Sanhedrin, so as he explains, that any time that a mitzvah in the Torah would be impossible without following Rove, so we have to assume that Rove is followed. So if we know the Torah says there's a chiyuv misa for hitting your father, and the only way to ascertain that somebody is actually the father of the person who hit him is based on Rove, so then it means that Rove must be incorporated into the din. If we know that a Sanhedrin has to occasionally execute people, and the Sanhedrin has to function based on Rove, as we mentioned yesterday, if it's unanimous, it's not even going to be a good ruling. So then, by definition, we have to follow Rove in such cases. So if not following Rove, means that a mitzvah is going to disappear, so then, of course, we'll have to follow Rove. But in a situation where there's a possibility of an iser ben adam l'chaveiro that will be violated if you follow this rule, such as gezel, or such as allowing somebody to die, then in those cases, as we want to follow rule. If it's a ben adam l'chaveiro, it's a ben adam l'makom, let's say they're eating non-kosher food, so then HaKadosh Baruch Hu sets the rules. He says, I'm okay with rule, so you can rely on rule for kasher. But to rely on Rove to take somebody's stuff away from him, to possibly commit a ben adam l'chaveiro against that person, we're too worried about that possibility, so we won't follow Rove in that case. Question?
For like taking away his life away, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we know, where would the Rove fall into play? You know, we know that the person hit his father, so
right.
What's the...
But we don't know the father as the father.
Right.
So the question is, since that's going to be a suffix by everyone,
right. So
the mitzvah exists, it has to rely on that, so therefore that's necessary. Okay, so some of that was a little complicated. Everyone good on all those things? Any questions about any of that? Okay, so just to make one more point about our Gemara, and then we'll start Chazar a little bit. So... And there were some guys were asking about this in Seder yesterday, so just to follow the Rove point a little bit further, just as far as how the Gemara continues its discussion. Right. So if you saw the Gemara, so first it says that Rov Nashim Basulus Nisais, right at the bottom of Tezayim Rav. So most women get married as a Basula, so therefore it would seem like she has that Rov on her side. So I asked the Gemara, Kaven the Rov Nashim Basulus Nisos, so Kilo Asi Eidim, my heavy, so then why does she need Eidim if there's no Eidim, then what should the story be? So Amar Ravina, Mishum de Ekolameima, Rov Nashim Basulos Nisais, Umiyot Almanos. Right, that most women are Basulos, but some of them are widows. Ve'echol HaNisais Basula Yesh La Kol. And one who gets married as a Basula, so people know about it. So says the Gemara Tapa Mamadeis, Vizu Ho'ol Ve'ech La Kol. And in this case, there was no knowledge of what happened. So therefore, since that's the case, Itra La Ruba, the Rove is weakened. The Rove takes a hit. So the Mares in that, well, E Kol HaNisais Psula Yesh La Kol, if you're going to tell me that, that every single time a Psula gets married, everyone knows about it. So, fine, that should be the whole story. Thank you. Also, Eidim, I have you. So who cares about Eidim who come and tell us she was married as a Psula? It's factually impossible, apparently. It's always going to be well known.
What does that mean? I mean, aren't there people that are informing us that it is
not? So, and I was discussing this with some of the guys yesterday, I think a good way just to put it in our world and make it understandable is, let's say, two Eidim come and say that there was an alien invasion of Manhattan yesterday. Right? So, you know, you were in Manhattan yesterday, and you're pretty sure that if there was an alien invasion, you would have noticed. It's pretty close to impossible that there could have been an alien invasion and you didn't hear about it. So if two Eidim come and say that happened yesterday, you'll say, sorry, you're lying. It's just not possible that happened and I didn't hear about it. So it sounds like the Havmin, the Gemara is about to take a different step in a second, but that the Havmin is that it was so well known when somebody gets married, you can imagine, let's say, a close friend of yours who you're with all the time. So then he happens to come to Seder, Tamar Chavrusa happens to come to Seder this morning and say, oh, by the way, I got married last night. No, you didn't. I know you did. I mean, I know you're not going out, it's impossible. So whatever you're telling me, I know it's not true. So too, it seems like the way the communities worked is that it was so self-evident that if this happened, it had to be public knowledge. So therefore, that would seem to set the stage. So the Gemara said, okay, well, if that's the case, it's so obvious. It's like an alien invasion of Manhattan. So then, well, the Eidim must be lying, right? If the Eidim come and tell you something that happened, then you know it couldn't happen without your hearing about it. So then it must be that these Eidim are no good. So then, okay, so Hanach Sadi Shakri the news. So these witnesses are liars. So no, that's not really the case. El Amar Avino Rov HaNisais Psuli Yesh Lakol. So in most of the cases, it's possible somebody gets married as a psula and they don't hear about it, but it's unlikely. That the way things are, it's pretty likely you hear about just about everything. So the idea that somebody could get married without it making a whole public smash, it's possible, but it's unlikely. So it's not an absolute, it's a rove. So if that's the case, so then concludes the Gemara, Vizu Ho'ol Ve'en Lakol Yitrula Ruba. So here, since this case, this woman, she claims she was married as a Psula, and she would have the robe on her side, but nobody heard about it, so now the robe kind of disappears. So just to discuss for a second, so what's going on here? Right. So it sounds like, first of all, we have been trying to figure out how a robe goes against Chazar, right? That was the discussion of the Me'alef. Then the husband seems to be the Mukhsak, and the question is, could the wife come with a robe and say, Rov Nashim Basulus Nisais? So now, as the discussion just took a different turn, so it sounds like we're saying, well, on the one hand, Rov Nashim Basulus Nisais, on the other hand, Rov Basulus is a call. So what does that mean? Does it mean now it's Rove versus Rove? Is that the case? Is that what's going on? Rove versus Wade?
There's only a Rove when you convert it.
Oh, so that's what it sounds like. That basically, you could have read this as a clash between two Roves. And Tosus almost sounds like that. Tosus over here says a line, to take it out of context for a second. V'yesh lomar derov nashim besulos nisos adif mirov nashim nisos besulos yesh lakal. Right? That basically, okay, yeah, it's a rove, one rove against the next, and this rove is stronger than the other. Which, again, kind of highlights how we're not really talking about any absolutes in this discussion. We talk about rove, chazaka, motzimamina rove, all these questions, migos, all these things. So on the one hand, we have these categories, and we kind of pit them up against each other. But then, within each one, we have weaker and stronger versions. Right? We saw with migo, we have a migo da'aza, and a normal migo, and a migo d'boyishasik, that they're not all created equal, that they have different weights to them. And so, too, we saw rove, we saw yesterday, we saw today, that maybe rove is also on a scale, that's a strong rove, a weak rove, etc., etc. So now chazakas are not all equal, that chazaka of cheskas mamun may be stronger than other chazakas. So it sounds like what Tosfos is saying here is that, well, we have the rove of psulas nises, and the rove of kol, and the rove of psulas nises is stronger. It's somehow a more powerful rove. But Achronim explained that they don't think that's really what's going on here. And I think it's, was it Morty who was just saying this? That essentially what this does, and really it's in the words of the Gemara, but it's just sometimes worth directing your attention to it to see how it's saying this, is that really this is all part of one calculation. That you have a rove that she's a psula based on most nashim get married as a psula. But there's something undermining the rove. It's not that the two rove are clashing with each other, but how could it be that she was married as a psula and we didn't hear about it? So the fact that we didn't hear about it, on the one, the havmina was it made it impossible. Then the conclusion was that impossible just makes it unlikely. So here we have a certain category. Now if you think about it in mathematical terms, so you'll say that, okay, most of the women in the world who got married, or at least in that day, the Jewish community of the time of the Amoraim, most of the women in the world who got married as a besula. But if we didn't hear about your besula wedding, so now that means you're not as likely to be a part of that set. So a random woman, we would say, okay, she's a part of this majority set. But a woman who also has the downside that we didn't hear about her besula wedding, so then that makes it a little bit less likely, or maybe significantly less likely, that she is a part of that set. So essentially what this other rove does, they're not facing off against each other, they're defining each other. Then that reality means that now the rove disappears, rove nashim besulas nises, and therefore she's left just with her fighting against the chazaka. And the only way she's going to win against this chazaka is if she has eight. So, if that's all the case, so then just dealing with this gemara by itself, so you could ask, so what's the maskana of the gemara then? So, would rove have worked against the chazaka? It's hard to know absolutely, but it sounds like from the conclusion of the gemara that maybe rove could have worked. And that it's just that ultimately the Gemara is talking about a case where there isn't really a rove. Because it also sounds like in a default situation, you wouldn't need aid. Right? It sounds like what the Gemara is essentially establishing is the whole Mishnah that talks about if there were aid. So the next passage in the Gemara, which maybe you've seen already because it was on the earlier Marmakomos, is also going to raise the question of whether there is a physical ksuba here or not. Right? If there's a physical ksuba, that would also seem to affect the situation. But if, so one question is what's going on in our context of our Mishnah. So this fight that's taking place between the husband's side and the wife's side, so what are the facts of the fight? So one fact is, was there a ksuba? And what this previous Gemara seems to be telling us is, it's also a kind of narrow situation where most of the marriages that happened, everyone knows the story. And this is one of the unusual situations where we don't know the story. Where we just have this woman coming and claiming she was married as a psula, and that's surprising to us in our small town because we would have known about it. So within that context, where this woman is really coming as an outlier, so then in that case, so then she has to have Adim to prove her position. So that's very significant, because it sounds like then what the Gemara, what the Mishnah is telling us, right? We wanted to use our Mishnah as a step in the whole process of figuring out where the default lies between a husband and a wife. And maybe the Mishnah is really rather narrow. It's only saying that in this outlier situation where a random couple comes and they're not subject to the knowledge that everyone else has, so then we'll say, okay,